What is really going on, crypto savages? This is your host, C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief out at coinspice.io, back with another episode of the CoinSpice podcast. And this time around, I've got Amy Castor. If the name rings a bell, that's because she has come on like a lion in the last few months, tackling the crypto space on her blog from any number of different angles. But she has more or less become the go-to person for Quadriga CX and all that happened with that giant Canadian cryptocurrency exchange basically falling apart. The story, if you haven't already heard it, I'll leave it for the episode, but it is, you know, it's only about 3 months old, the news of it. We covered it early on at CoinSpice with a really cool video that got a lot of traction by Hayden Otto, our executive editor. But the story has gone on from there and taken on legs, and it's just an amazing thing. But Amy both is the go-to person to explain what's happened, and she's also become part of the story as sort of a loosely affiliated payments processor company went after her and threatened all sorts of legal stuff with her, trying to shut her up. So this, I thought it was important to get her on the show right now and to get her side of things. You'll immediately be blown away by her depth of knowledge and her meticulous, you know, steady hand when it comes to the facts. So she is a valuable person in the space, even if she's not necessarily a crypto savage herself. She provides a much, much needed light. So in any case, without any further ado, and by the way, get some milk. This one gets spicy. So if you're the vegan type of person and you need, you know, soy or almond milk, I'm not going to judge you. Go for it. Without any further ado, here is Amy Castor.
What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the CoinSpice podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at coinspice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
Well, this is kind of a long time coming. I found you through the Quadriga news and became kind of obsessed with your blog and your reporting on the subject, but I have to say right away, leave us alone, Amy. Leave us alone. You're too deep in there. Just do something else. Write about something else. Anyway, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So let's get into a little bit about your background here as a muckraker.
Oh, no.
Yeah, troublemaker. Kicking up dust in the cryptocurrency space. How did you find us? How did you find this crazy little world?
Oh, well, I've always been involved in the tech space in one form or another. I started off a long, long time ago working at Xerox. That was my first job out of college as a sales rep. And so I just always stayed in the tech space. And, you know, for the last couple decades, I've written about it in some form or another. And then in recent years, some odd years ago, I sort of got pulled into the blockchain cryptocurrency space because I guess I thought it was interesting.
And down the rabbit hole you've gone, eh? You're a self-described no-coiner, so I think I can. Well, I already kind of know the answer to the question, but have you ever held or used a crypto? Had a wallet and sure.
I mean, I had some Bitcoin and a couple of other coins that I played with, but you know, when the markets were going crazy in 2017, it just, you know, I couldn't take it and made me too nervous. I just wanted to get out of it, you know. And since then, I haven't gotten back in. I think it's better for me to stay a no-coiner.
And that has been the sort of the default case for journalists like Nathaniel Popper, who wrote of the New York Times fame. He wrote Digital Gold, and he is a self-described no-coiner in the sense that he feels it's almost a conflict of interest. I think you can kind of go either way on that one.
Yeah, I think it does. And it, you know, I don't want to get I don't want to get pulled into trading or get obsessed with it. I mean, there were times when sometimes people would pay you in Bitcoin as a journalist. But so I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah. And now do you think that gives you a completely different perspective when you cover aspects of the ecosystem?
Look, let's be honest. I'm not getting rich here as a journalist. So it's not like, I have that much fiat to play with either. So excuse me, but I mean, my perspective is that I'm a poor journalist. So it's
all right. And when you think of cryptocurrency, and we're going to get kind of knee deep into Quadriga here. And wow, your odyssey. What's your overall impression? If you just give me like a, you know, having some perspective now, having written about it, been online, interacted socially with this group of Motley Crue misfits. What's sort of your general sense of crypto?
Crypto in general? Well, you know, it would be nice if we could see a real strong use case other than trading. You know, I guess I see some of the negative aspects of it. You know, it's mostly been used for trading, and some of those markets are manipulated, and it hasn't really proven out to be a good payment system. So that's my perspective. I mean, I could go on and on about it, but I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Oh, no, no. I you know, that's the, kind of giving you so that when we get into these, you know, sort of weeds here of Quadriga and all that happened, you know, so people kind of understand how you approach things. Well, very good then. How did you, so we at CoinSpice found Quadriga after the formal filing by the widow.
Jennifer Robertson.
Mm-hmm. So she comes into our orbit, and I'm now trying to sort of reconstruct the chronology in my head.
January 31st, 2019.
Yeah, something like that. And so somehow we get the PDF, we get the 300 some odd page, whatever, document that's filed with the courts, and we pore over it and find a lot of irregularities, strange things that are being said. No death certificate at the time. There was like a mild, you know, sort of acknowledgement, and then weird. Just all sorts of coincidences. So when do you discover Quadriga? Like when does that hit you?
Well, I remember reading about it back when the CIBC, which is one of the big banks in Canada, froze, was it 26 million CAD of their funds in January 2018. So that's kind of when they really kind of appeared on my radar. But I didn't pay as much attention until later on when there was this funny business going on in the exchange. People weren't getting any response. They were having trouble getting their money out.
Right.
Right. And
they were starting to squawk. There was a Reddit.
There was tension, and there were a lot of people thinking, okay, this is all, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine, everybody. And then, you know, December 9th was 2018 was when... No, and there's a lot of dates here, so sometimes it gets scrambled. But so January of this year was when sort of the shit started hitting the fan, and before that there was a lot of rationalizing. Well, the funds were not getting them out because of the stuff with CIBC, and the funds are frozen, but it's going to be okay because it looks like it's working out well in the court system. And
And a lot of us were really stung if we've been around for a while and active in trading and using and a lot of even cryptocurrency enthusiasts, those who enjoy the medium of exchange aspect, they use exchanges to kind of off and onboard into fiat, as it were. And so it's good in with bunny ears here to have a little bit of your funds on an exchange just to make them more liquid. As it were, getting in and out as things go. And so a lot of us were still stung by the Mt. Gox stuff that happened in 2014. Right. And this immediately did not smell like that to me. And so even though I'm in the business, and so I just kind of I kind of blew it off.
Yeah, and people, the customers of the exchange, they were being told all along that everything was okay. It's all fine, you know, we'll have the funds, we'll have things worked out. And even after, so Gerald, CEO of the exchange, Gerald Cotton, he died on December 9th, but that information was withheld from all the right. users of the exchange, and it wasn't revealed until January 14th, 2019. That was like over a month later. And even after that, they were being told that everything was okay and the exchange was still accepting fiat. People were still moving fiat to the exchange or crypto funds. So, I mean, everybody was told that this was kind of it was all going to be honky-dory until, you know, the door closed on January 31st.
And that's the seizure you're talking about, or
that was the big awakening. I mean, up till then, I mean, even people thought there was some funny business, say after Gerald died, and then there was supposed to be a shareholder meeting because there was no director, and Jennifer Robertson was sort of left in charge of the company. So they had a shareholder meeting on January 25th. And that was on a Friday, and everybody kept thinking, well, surely we'll get some news after this. Nothing on Friday, no news on Saturday, no news on Sunday. Surely on Monday we'll hear something. On Monday, the site goes down for maintenance. And then it wasn't until 3 days, and then 3 days after that, you know, everything was, it was all over, because that was when the first affidavit was filed with the courts.
And I think that's about where we get it at CoinSpice and start reading it, going, huh.
And even before people read the affidavit, there was a message on the website. And that was the real, I mean, I can remember that going up because I was checking the website every day. And then there was a message, and there was something in there about blah, blah, blah. We can't locate, we're having trouble locating the funds in the cold wallets. And it was like,
right.
And I could see it trickle down through social media on Twitter. And at first it was sort of like, no, but you didn't, you have to read it again a few times. What do you, the funds, the keys to the cold wallets are gone?
Yeah. What do you mean by gone? And how could that possibly be missing? And so the stories of
exit. That's when the anger, that's when people started getting really angry.
And there's some details that we've skipped over that are salacious and maybe not super important, but it adds to sort of the drama of really setting off this insane amount of publicity and news, in that you said that Gerald Cotton, the founder or at least co-founder and CEO, kind of the main man, had died and left his widow, who was, as far as we know, completely had nothing to do with cryptocurrency, didn't run the exchange, and they were just married a few weeks prior to his I'm not laughing at his death. I'm laughing at the comedy of circumstances here.
Yeah, there's so many little like rabbit holes you could tunnel down into in this whole story. It just goes on and on. So and that's sort of why I put together this timeline. So
yeah.
All the resources are there. So anybody who's researching it won't get lost.
Right. And so he dies in India.
He dies in India on December 9th.
Yeah, a whole brouhaha about whether he's actually dead, because his will a couple weeks beforehand was updated, but that seems to be right in line with getting married and, you know, resorting your life. And then he dies, and then
he dies. Uh-huh. So they had the will on November 27th, 2018, was when he signed a very detailed will. And then shortly after that, toward the end of the month, they headed off to India. So it just seemed odd that he had put all this effort into creating a very detailed will. But then when you look at the business and how Quadriga was handled, you see so much negligence. And it just starts at, to begin with, there's no cold wallets, there's no booking, and it just goes on from there, negligence. For example, I mean, just seems to be no regard for where the money went or how it was handled or any of that.
That starts to become very clear through at least the affidavit and some of the posting and then taking down on the website, which I know we're jumping around, or I'm jumping around a little bit here.
Mm.
So then
it's hard not to jump around because it's such a big,
such
a big story.
Right. And we're only in, we're recording this now at the end of March. This was, you know, not that long ago. It's not ancient history. You know, we're still involved in this. So in any case, so take us through then so the affidavit's out, the website's going back and forth. People are starting to get a little angry. Rumors are floating and
they're really pissed off because, now all this is in the first affidavit that Jennifer Robertson files with the court. And all these numbers that we have in terms of how many people were on the exchange, 115,000 customers, how much money was supposedly being held on the exchange or owed to those customers, how their funds, which is something like, and I've just switched back between CAD and USD, but it was like 250 million,
right? Million. So it's right around a quarter of a billion bucks.
190 million USD, so about 70 million CAD owed in fiat. So these are unaudited numbers, and that's important to take note of.
Yes, yes.
You know, so the court appointed monitor in the CCAA case, Ernst & Young, hasn't really fact-checked all those numbers, so we just have to go with what's on that first affidavit. Right now we're waiting for the fourth monitor report to come out. And I'm sure there'll be a few more bombs dropped there. The monitor reports are interesting because they're written in this sort of real bland language, you know.
that's where everything's kind of, to me.
And then you go, what? Yeah, what do you mean? You can't find the cold wallet. You can't. So anyhow.
It turns out that the cold wallets that exist, most of my listeners know already what a cold wallet is, but a hot wallet would be something that is either web-based or attached to
the servers attached to the internet
and so on, right? And so a cold wallet is usually offline, and that is kind of considered sort of the minimum standard for anybody who holds, regardless of whether you're an exchange or not, the minimum standard by which you hold significant amounts of crypto. You put it in a cold wallet so that it can't be messed with. And then exchanges seem to be, at least in this case, no better than my friend Frank, who lives with his mom in his basement, and he's got his treasurer there. So it was wild to learn that something akin to that was going on with this many millions of dollars of exchange funds. And then kind of talk a little bit about the revelations about those cold wallets.
So we all, in the last monitor report, which had been the third monitor report that came out, I think it was March 1st, so it was a while ago, so we're waiting for that, the next one to come out any time. In Ernst & Young, by the way, they're the accountants who go through all the numbers, all the information. It's their job to track down the missing funds and to figure out whether they're gone for good or, are the third-party payment processors holding them? Who's holding them, et cetera? What was the question? What about the cold wallets? Everybody's wondering, you know, if Gerald Cotton died and there was supposedly $190 million in crypto funds in these cold wallets that have disappeared, he's had the private keys to, where then are the addresses to these cold wallets so we can verify that the funds actually exist? Because we should at least be able to see that they're there, even if we can't access them or move them. And that's been the thing. Nobody has really known where those cold wallets are, so that Ernst & Young was able to do, they found six cold wallets that had previously been used to store Bitcoin. And they pretty much are all empty. Most of them were emptied by April 2018. So what we're seeing is that we're not finding all this money that is supposed to be there. We, Ernst & Young, the money's not showing up. Right now, they've probably found, maybe identified 30 million roughly in fiat funds, and those were held by two payment processors.
Wow. And so the that all starts because basically it's assumed that Cotton, who now is dead, held those cold wallets and didn't bother to share the keys, the passphrases, with anybody else. And so it's c'est la vie, right? It was thought gone. And then Ernst & Young is hired, and they've able to track down, like you say, six wallets. And the only money so far that they've been able to locate or perhaps recover is actually through, ironically enough, a third-party payment processor. So that, again, that's enough of a story to last you a lifetime, and there's so many lessons there, and I'm sure governments are going to pick up on it if they haven't already.
Well, it's just, I mean, most of the money apparently is gone, but then again, we don't really know for sure how much money was there, because like right. I said, all these are unaudited numbers. And remember that in the third monitor report too, they also talked about 14 accounts on the exchange that were being used as aliases by people within Quadriga to trade, you know, fake accounts used for trading fake money.
Right. So it's kind of like levels of plausible deniability,
so,
right?
Yeah, so what they're trying to do is they're trying to gain access to the data and the administrative data and the historical data from the exchange that's being held in the Amazon web servers up in the cloud. And once they get that, they'll be able to get an idea of, you know, all the KYC and a better sense of, you know, what was going on with these fake accounts, and maybe some of these funds aren't real or something, and they'll
right.
hopefully be able to come up with a better sense of what the real numbers are.
Now, regardless of our personal preferences for going into a story as, oh, this is an obvious scam or whatever, as a journalist, you kind of have to set that aside and just kind of go with, I'm trying to phrase it well, but it's not coming out right. We cannot say that Gerald Cotton was up to anything bad or wrong or criminal or anything like that, because we're just not there yet, or at all. But we can.
I think it is.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that there was a huge amount of negligence. Negligence is the
right
word I would use.
Right, and I don't even know if that's a financial term in the sense of you like I'm trying to be overly careful to get to this point, which is we don't need that. So we don't need to go into his psychological motivation, whether he was a go-go anarchist who was trying to screw everybody, or something, you know, just a series of comedy of errors. It's just, this could have happened quite literally as it almost is unraveling or appears to be, which is that the dude just didn't have, he just didn't take the necessary precautions with other people's money, which I guess is the definition of negligence. I don't need to. I can do this all on my own.
I mean, and there. I can go into examples too. I mean, it wasn't just the Please. Not having the keys to the cold wallets or not having left the addresses to the cold wallets, but things like, you know, they had supposedly, according to the first affidavit, that that one third party payment processor, and I don't know if I should explain this.
No, please.
Taking a drink, but there's, you know, I get so far into this, you start to assume that people know things, but Quadriga didn't have any banking, so they relied on sort of these workarounds to the traditional banking system where all the money would pass through a third-party payment processors. So when you had an account on a Quadriga and you'd look into your account, you'd see you had this many, you know, crypto and this many dollars, but those weren't real dollars. They were quad bucks, right? It was another digital
right.
asset called a quad buck, and Quadriga didn't hold your money. The money was being held in accounts by these third-party exchanges, of which there are, I think, now 10 that Ernst & Young has identified. So one of the third-party exchanges is called WB21.
Right.
And
they're based out of Switzerland.
I think they're in London.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and anybody who's listening to this podcast, I have a timeline, and if you go onto my website, you can amycaster.com. There's that Quadriga timeline. You can check all these dates, and I have everything written down there.
It is a Herculean effort, and we will link to it definitely.
So double check everything on there. Now, so they started getting involved with WB21. I want to say.
Hey, Crypto Savages. This is C. Edward Kelso breaking in with a quick and very shameless plug. Coinspice.io is a feisty pirate ship. We depend, rely on almost entirely organic growth, which means our audience really does the marketing for us. And there's nothing more powerful than word of mouth. If you read an article you like on coinspice.io, if you listen to a podcast and you enjoy the content, or if you're just pissed, please promote us on social media, wherever you're at, wherever that is, whether it's Reddit, whether it's YouTube, Telegram, you name it, Twitter, like us, retweet, all that great stuff. You can always find detailed show notes for every podcast on the corresponding page at coinspice.io. There you'll find links to our respective podcast, your favorite platform like iTunes. Please give us a rating. Please give us a subscribe. You know all that good stuff. It helps the pirate ship remain afloat. It keeps us going. We appreciate it. As always, you can contact me personally if you have questions, concerns, you want to hear from a particular guest, you have a news tip at Kelso, K-E-L-S as in Sam, O, at coinspice.io. Thanks again for listening. We sure do appreciate it. And back to the episode.
2017. Maybe September 2017. There was somebody on Reddit, a couple things on Reddit saying, you know, I'm not getting my money out of WB21. It's not coming through. And somebody from Quadriga said, well, we're just testing them out. Well, I think that's interesting that they would partner with that company, because you don't have to, I mean, you just do a little Google search and you see the internet is littered with people that say that they've put money into WB21 and it's never come out again. So, yet in the affidavit, it'll say that WB21 is holding now 9 million USD of Quadriga funds. That's, you know, that's not small change. That's a significant amount of money. Why would you partner with a company that has a bad reputation, you know, that is known for taking people's money and, you know, holding on to it? Why would you have a business partner like that? And if you're testing them out, why do you let it get to a point where there's $9 million that are missing? So that's what I mean by just not doing due diligence.
At the very least.
Right. There were accounts that Ernst & Young is pulling up, for example, that seemed to be, there was $200,000 in one account that was sort of just forgotten about. So it's almost like they didn't know where the money was. There was no bookkeeping, and you keep digging, there's more and more examples of this.
And there are some, we'll get back to WB21, but they're also during these uncoverings and these revelations, which, at least we were, I wouldn't say we were the first by any stretch, but, we highlighted back in early February, maybe February 4th, that, there's kind of an unsavory character that's undergirding a lot of what's going on with Quadriga, and
unsavory. Unsavory? Who? Who's unsavory?
Exactly.
Who's being unsavory.
Well, I'm gonna kind of let you tell it, but I will lead the witness.
I think that you're referring to the co-founder, so Gerald Cotton, right? Uh-huh. He co-founded the exchange with Michael Patron.
Right.
Who we now know is actually Omar Danani. I can never say that name.
Right. And
who's a convicted felon.
Exactly. And this
and a
is
money launderer.
Exactly. From the United States. And so my executive editor found that and put it in a video. And we got a lot of crap about that, saying, oh, that's just supposition and all this other stuff. But he just did a modest amount of, I mean, just it was almost like with WB21, that just a modest amount of research, and this goes back to your negligence, lack of due diligence. And again, I'm just going to assume that he didn't know.
Why would you assume that?
Well, just because I want to go into it with. So I want to let the evidence guide me rather than, you know what I mean? Like it's sort of like finding an arrow and then painting a bullseye around it versus the other way around, I guess.
Mm.
But anyway, it's just the way, but you're obviously free to do and say whatever you'd like. So there's this guy in the background that if you just do a basic check, you find a nexus of information, which you've kind of already said, but can you go into him just a little bit?
Well, I think Gerald Cotton may have known who Michael Patron was, because I think that they allegedly they've had connections in the past before they formed Quadriga. And by the way, Quadriga was founded in November 2013.
Yeah.
So it's one of the it's one of the older exchanges, and it was the largest crypto exchange in Canada.
Unbelievable. And so he links up with this guy, Michael.
And now, by the way, so Michael Patron is actually he's a co-founder, but he says that he's really an advisor.
Right.
So according to some lawsuits that I've read, he was making like $5,000 a month as an advisor, you know, and he did that for a while. And so Quadriga's founded in November, late 2013. Is it November? I start to get confused about these
dates.
Okay.
You know,
many of them.
It's founded.
But very quickly after that, say maybe it was November, maybe. So it's very quickly after that, it was like summer 2013, they were thinking about Quadriga. Yeah, so November 2013 is when they're formed, but probably soon after that, like in 2014, late 2014, they came up with this idea to kick the company public. That's kind of an interesting twist in the whole story. They wanted to take the company public because really Quadriga wasn't profitable, you know, in the beginning. It wasn't doing well in 2014 and in 2015. So Patron, seemed like mostly Patron's pushing this idea to take the company public. So they raised like a bunch of money, to do that. And then after that, Patron, it was this guy, Richard Lawrence, a businessman in Vancouver, was helping them take it public, and they raised like initially $850,000 CAD and capital from several Canadian brokerage houses. And then, but they never did go public, and a bunch of people ended up with shares in the company, and Patron sued Richard Lawrence blamed Richard Lawrence for the reason that the company didn't go public, and also blamed Richard Lawrence for the reason why he split with Gerald Cotton. And supposedly by early 2016, well, the other directors of the company all stepped down, and supposedly then Michael Patron split ways with Gerald Cotton and was no longer actively involved in the company. That's the storyline.
Storyline, yep.
That's the storyline, which is sort of interesting.
It is, and it gets so basically as
so.
It's
so left, we're basically we're left with this idea to believe that
one guy,
that Cotton, is just like this one man band. He's got these contractors and everything like that, and he's handling all this money by himself. So that's sort of the storyline.
That's at least what they're pushing forward now anyway. And so you and some others have discovered some interesting revelations in the third-party processor part, and money was actually moved after, or I should say crypto was moved actually to a hot wallet, some are saying through automation, after
that was inadvertently,
his death. And can you go into that just a little bit?
Well, after his death, I mean, right up until I believe January 31st, is the exchange was still taking money and funds. So it was like there were no shutoff buttons. And after she Robertson and her lawyers filed for creditor protection on February 5th, 2019.
Yeah.
And on February 6th, the day after, another from the hot wallets, which are connected to the internet, which was the only crypto that they had left, about half of that money in the form of Bitcoin was inadvertently sent through an automatic process to the cold wallets. It was just sort of like jettisoning them to outer space because they're gone for good. So it was like more of the creditors' money was just poof, gone. That was very strange, you know, but it was sort of like, you know, why wasn't these things turned off? Why was the exchange still accepting money? Why did nobody know that? Why was nobody told when Gerald Cotton died on December 9th? He was the CEO of the company. I mean, that's kind of like big news. Hey, everybody, the CEO is dead.
Right. You know? And if they're putting forward this idea that Cotton was running things all on his own, I mean, that it becomes even more important then, right? I mean, obviously you would do that anyway, but if he's...
Yeah, why wasn't everything immediately shut down or put on pause at that point until they could figure out what was going on? So that's sort of a big question. And what happened to those funds? What happened to the fiat that was sent to the exchange after that date? You know, what was the trail of money? Where was the crypto going? So,
yeah, super, super, super interesting. So in the timeline now, you've got us into the beginning or middle of last month, and some interesting things happen, especially as you get closer to WB21. Am I skipping over too much there? Is there anything?
I don't know.
I'm with you 100% on that.
It's a big plate of spaghetti. You know, you have to kind of pull out all the noodles.
Well, I want to touch on because I do think this is something beyond the intrigue and the financial intrigue. If people are kind of going, okay, guys, we got it. We got it. We got it. You know, things are, you know, we don't know what's going on. We got it. But I think one of the more interesting things to happen is that you became a part of the story, not on purpose, but just by being dogged and by documenting things that you've found and making connections, because again, you've become this clearinghouse, this repository of all things Quadriga. And so you have this holistic kind of universal view that I would say very few other people have. And you're now literally the go-to gal. So you start to make these connections and you bring up the idea of the processor WB21 and you say some, how do I put this? You frame them in a rather unflattering light and in a light that they would not prefer to be.
Go ahead. There have been a lot of things that have been written on WB21 before. So I sort of pulled that all up and put it together. And that this is a third-party payment processor that has a terrible reputation. You know, I mean, they've there have been articles written about them that have been taken offline. I mean, there's a lot of really weird things going on with that WB21, and they recently just rebranded. They changed their name.
I definitely want to get into that because I think that that's you.
So. I don't think so. That okay. now that they had that company for a while, but they recently rebranded where they moved everything over on their website.
Sure.
So that may have been in planning for a while. I don't know if it's just, you know, sure.
I think at the very least. Anyway, so we're jumping ahead because we both know what happened. For those who don't know, so you start to make connections with WB21, bringing up their past dealings as you find them in public sources. Their articles being taken down mysteriously, and all of a sudden you're contacted. Can you kind of take us through that?
Well, sure. So I wrote that article about them, which I posted on my blog because I've been writing a lot of articles independently, you know. So then I reached out to them the best I could. You know, I just had to guess what their email is because they don't really have a media contact. So it was sort of like, you know, info@wb21.com, you know, and
which is always media a great
press at, you know, whatever, see if one of them goes through. So finally, after I wrote the article, somebody under Amish Patel was the name of the person, which is kind of a ghost online. I'm not even sure it was a real person or somebody pretending to be somebody else, contacted me and basically, you know, so pretty, yeah, they threatened me with, you know, coming at me with legal threats.
So but, they you begin know, I, to try to
get me to change everything in the story. But you know, I mean, they've come after every reporter that's written about them. I mean, they do that. They make legal threats to everybody that writes about them. They had another reporter that said, you know, a thug showed up at his door after he wrote stories about this payment processor. So that's just their
macro.
That's just their MO. You know, they're trying to squash as much bad press as possible. At the same time, they're trying to artificially manufacture as much good press as possible.
Sure. And they initially, from what I read, they try to correct the record and try to get into, you know, saying to you, here's actually what happened. You're misconstruing this or that. And yeah. you out of, you know, you certainly don't take anything down, but you do.
I published the emails and stuff of what they said because, my friend David Gerard encouraged me to do that because he'd had a lot of experience before working with, well, I'll let you can tell you about that, but I had a conversation with him and then he kind of suggested, and I thought, well, that would be a good idea to just publish whatever documents they sent me and make them public, you know, and that could be used for journalistic purposes.
It does a couple of things. One is it rounds out the story. Mm-hmm. Two, it shows how they approach the matter. And so I think it was a genius move. And David Gerard, for those who don't know, is another troublemaker like Amy. And we had him on the podcast. He's the author of the Attack of the 50-foot Blockchain and another vital source in the space. But getting back to WB21 and how they approached you, so was it right off the bat aggressive and you need to take this down?
Yeah, I mean, you can see all the documents because they're online, what they wrote me. It was a threat, but it didn't even bother me. I would have almost thought nothing of it.
Right, and it didn't seem...
The CEO of the company is already being sued by the SEC. Why would you want to come after me and drag yourself through? It just doesn't make any sense. So I wasn't really too worried about it. And by the way, they do accept Bitcoin, this payment processor, through BitPay, which is another payment processor which allows you to turn Bitcoin into fiat. So some people were using them because they saw it as a way to, you know, in a lot of places around the world, it's hard to cash out on Bitcoin.
Yes.
So if they could send it to a payment processor and then, you know, have cash wired to them, that would be an option. But in instances that I've been, you know, it seems that people are sending their money to WB21 and their Bitcoin there, and WB21 is actually keeping it. That's what I'm seeing online and what some people have told me.
Yeah,
that experience.
It's starting to it just unleashed a new round of criticism of WB21, and then something even more interesting happened, which you alluded to as
they rebranded. They redid their website, and now they're Black Banks, I think. What is it?
Which so, sounds awesome.
but the real thing, bringing it back to Quadriga, is again, it's interesting that they would choose that as a business partner. I don't know if they were just desperate to find payment processors or they just didn't do any due diligence at all. But the fact that, you know, this company the payment processor that already has kind of a bad reputation online, to use them and then continue using them, to the point where $9 million USD is caught up in that payment processor, says something, I think.
I think it does as well. And what do you think, now that we have a better handle on anecdotal and also legal and social media evidence, what do you think, so far anyway, because we still need to, you know... Ironically, when events like this happen, the further away you get from them, the actual more you understand them. But at least for now, can you draw any conclusions? I mean, you definitely...
You're supposed to ask me, do I think Gerald Cotton killed himself? Do I think he... No, it wasn't that. Sorry. Erase. Do I think he faked his death?
Well, I mean...
that's what everybody asks me, ultimately. I get these...
Yeah, answers. You know, we...
Do you think he faked his death?
Well, we put up the video and...
Do you think Jennifer Robertson poisoned him?
Yeah.
And then I had another one. Somebody wrote me and said, do you think he was keeping all his cold wallet keys in a USB stick, and maybe he swallowed them and that's what perforated his bowel and that's why he died?
Wow. Well, there's
a theory. I thought that was funny. That's a theory?
Yeah, that is definitely a theory.
You can toss that one in the bucket with all the others and kind of shake it up and, you know, see
where it is. Well, it's you know, we're less inclined to go down that road now. Well, as soon as we published it and we alluded to there, because where he died in India, and I know you didn't mean to go into this, but where he died in India was actually a notorious sort of state or a region where people faked such documents. So sure. We just kind of put that, we put those connections out there, and then people sort of ran with it, and the, not the widow, but someone claiming to be a sister or connected to the family or something, went off on anybody who would mildly suggest some, and I get that.
Really?
You know.
Well, I think what's important to note is that there is a market for fake death certificates in India. You know, there is a certain level of corruption in that country where you can get a, you know, you can stage a death for insurance reasons or whatever, right? So that's a market there for that. And the other thing is to note that Quadriga was really in a lot of trouble before it went, you know, it went down. It was taking on water. I mean, they had, let's see. I mean, there was in June 2017, they had because of a software glitch, the exchange lost 67,000 Ether, which was worth about 14 million USD at the time.
It was starting to boom.
So, yeah, I mean, that was a lot of money. And that was as, you know, Ether was kind of going up in price. So it was only worth at the time maybe a couple hundred bucks, one Ether. But, you know, by the end of the year, it was worth maybe 3.5 or 4 times that much. So that was a significant loss. Let's see. So, and then, you know, so then, and then after that, they had issues with WBT1, you know, holding a lot of their money. So there was another 9 million USD. And then the whole thing with the CIBC, the bank in Canada, that froze a bunch of money, right? Because they didn't know what was going on with those accounts. Right, so another payment processor, Billerfy, or they were working under the name Custodian, had set up accounts at CIBC, and
that's exactly when I turn to my new wife and I say, "Honey, let's go to India and let's help out an orphanage."
So, but if the exchange was in trouble, if they were operating in a fractional reserve, it was getting probably at that time. Toward December 2018, it was becoming harder for them to keep up appearances. Let's put it that way. So people, you know, traders were seeing that it was taking them a lot longer to withdraw their funds, right? So usually you could get money wired to you within 2 weeks, right? And then it was taking 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks. It was taking longer, but And then Gerald died.
What an unbelievable story. And I promised you that I'd keep you for 30 minutes, and I've definitely lied to you about that. It is something that we could go on and on and on and on and on about. And I encourage everybody to get out to Amy Castor's blog, which I will link to in the show notes. Where else can we find you and your work, and where can people follow you?
Well, everything's on my website, amycastor.com, so you can sign up for my website, and I am reader-supported.
Nice. You have a Patreon.
So I have a Patreon account.
Very good, and she's got a newsletter that you can subscribe to. She's on Twitter as well.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, you are doing fantastic work. I still say, leave us alone, damn it, Amy. someone's got to shut you up. But I'm, of course, joking about that. You are one of the good guys, and you're out there keeping the industry honest. And I think we're better for it, whether or not people like yourself or Mr. Gerard or whomever else ultimately find it all to be just, you know, so much fuckery and we just need to burn the whole thing down. I believe in the future of the basic idea, and for that to have any sort of legs, we have to be tested. It you know, you've got to keep these guys honest, and so I think you do an extremely valuable service. Even though we may disagree on some things, you cannot be denied. So thank you so much for all the time and for coming on.
Oh, Edward, thank you.